Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your German Navy of today. Heinz, Sarah, ladies and gentlemen, uncertainty is an inherent part of seafaring. Perhaps it's a defining one. For centuries, people have sought to reduce that uncertainty. Thanks to continuous technical progress, the perfection of nautical procedures and scientific breakthroughs, we can go on voyages today that our predecessors could only dream of. Yet we also know that uncertainty can never be eliminated altogether. This is due to two factors: the nature of the sea, which cannot be controlled, and human nature, which cannot be controlled either. Early in his career, a young watch officer serving on the fast patrol boat Iltis encountered both. It was in the spring of 1989, and the young officer was Lieutenant Jan Christian Karg, my younger self. Following a night alarm, my unit had to make ready for sea at a moment's notice, together with the entire squadron. Without any preparation time, we got underway into a foggy night on pitch black waters. Running in silence mode, and that is with all radar and radio systems switched off, we sailed through our home waters at a steady and slow pace, adapted to the poor visibility we had at east, using the cover of the Danish islands. I had no idea what mission would await us at our destination, nor how long we would remain at sea. We had state-of-the-art technology and felt extremely well-trained and confident. Nevertheless, this sortie sent us into the unknown, a scenario in which I had been before many times, which is integral to all of our profession. Suddenly and completely unexpected, a Volksmarine torpedo boat appeared out of the fog and rushed past us, a mere 150 meters away, an arm's length in nautical terms. The enemy units had been called into action by our presence. In that foggy night early in 1981, no one was expecting anything like the fall of the Berlin Wall. In spite of that, it happened in November of that same year, inevitable from today's point of view. As we learned later, our activation was an alert drill, and it had apparently hit the adversary's nerve. For me, it was the first such direct encounter with the adversary at sea. It would take an entire soldier's lifetime before tensions in the Baltic reached a comparable level again. Moments like these shaped my first years in the Federal German Navy, which later than simply German Navy, would navigate entirely different geopolitical waters. Only a few months after my encounter with the Volksmarine in the fog, we once again put to sea into the unknown, but this time with a feeling of relief and full of optimism. The Cold War was over. We were the young people who all of a sudden could go anywhere we liked. We were sailing into a period of lasting peace. Adversaries were going to become friends. This is possibly and probably what most people thought at that time. What many asked would be, need armed forces at all? The German army went out its first out-of-area deployments for peacekeeping. During the Gulf War, our Air Force witnessed the true meaning of air power, and the Navy completed one of the Bundeswehr's first operations outside Germany in the form of Operation Southern Flank in 1990 and 91. The mission, unprecedented at that time, was to clear mines in the Persian Gulf. Probably this new area, the rapprochement within Europe, and the use of armed forces for conflict management has shaped my entire generation far more than the period of tension that had just ended. During the Cold War, the German Navy had more than 200 warships, from small mine hunters to large air defense destroyers. The Navy was exceptionally well trained and well equipped. The military contingency for which we prepared was an interstate conflict in Europe, and our benchmark was high-intensity combat at sea. Now the task became to save money and resources. The prevailing sense that liberal democracy had triumphed started to question logic of large standing forces, a major conflict had become unlikely. Which strategic direction we would take became clear in 2001, when the illusion of peace collapsed along with the World Trade Center. The global war on terror brought about an entirely new set of requirements for the German Navy. A threat originating far away no longer required the constant presence of naval forces in our home waters, the North Sea and the Baltic. At that time, the Navy had to take a directional decision. It decided to meet the politically imposed imperative to cut costs by applying the principle of breadth before depth. In other words, our goal was to maintain the whole range of military capabilities, from naval mine countermeasures to anti-submarine warfare to long-range reconnaissance. This was clearly a bold move, given we were assigned fewer personnel and a much smaller budget. We were no longer able to maintain the various ship classes in large numbers. We had to shrink, sacrificing depth across the capability spectrum in order to preserve breadth. Today, with the reestablishment of ground-based air defense in the Bundeswehr, as well as the political debate over the reintroducing a compulsory military service, we all realize how easy it is to abolish a capability and how arduous it is to rebuild one. After several rounds of downsizing, the Navy was left at only about a quarter of the combat power of the Cold War era. This put high pressure on the fleet, a pressure that we are still feeling today. One reason was our determination, despite the focus on international crisis management, to retain the ability to conduct high-intensity combat at sea. Today, we may take some pride in the fact that we succeeded in preserving this very essence. Exercises may no longer have been as frequent or as grueling as those I experienced during my time as a young fast patrol officer during the Cold War. But one thing is certain, the German Navy never forgot how to fight. Let us take a closer look on the so-called military advice we gave at that time. Military advice, that is a standing term for the counsel by the military leadership towards political decision makers. The advice was breadth over depth, coupled with the ambition to remain effective at the sharp end of naval warfare. Was this military advice the best that could be achieved under the circumstances? Perhaps. I think yes. For my part, I concluded that the role of military leadership is not to cater to the political zeitgeist. Our role is to provide honest and critical advice at all times, and especially when what we have to say might be quite unpopular. The organization of the state's armed forces always reflects the political will to use them to enforce political objectives. This explains why the Bundeswehr had reached a historic low in personnel and material just as the geopolitical winds in Europe began to shift in the mid-2010s. Many security policy experts say nowadays that Russia's war against the West and against Europe began long before 22, and that we should have changed course much earlier. Such assessments overlook the fact that both NATO and the Bundeswehr did indeed make a strategic shift at a time when thousands of German soldiers were still fighting the Taliban in Afghanistan. And we tend to forget that in the year 2014, the Bundeswehr was committed to more than 10 overseas missions. For me too, the Russian invasion of Crimea in 2014 came as a shock. NATO quickly began drawing up defense plans for its eastern flank again and deployed the first multinational battle groups in the Baltic states, initially as a tripwire. Yet the international focus remained on counter-terrorism operations. Around the year 2015, the so-called Islamic State had seized large parts of Syria and Iraq. The Bundeswehr was still launching new missions in the Middle East. And as for myself, having only recently been promoted to Rear Admiral, I was called to Djibouti in 2016 to serve in Operation Atalanta, the mission by which the European Union curbed piracy and the spread of terrorism at the Horn of Africa. The Navy still had to deliver in both areas, restore defense readiness across the full breadth of its capabilities, and fulfill multinational commitments to NATO, the EU, and the United Nations. It is important to note that crisis management continued to take precedence. The double burden wore us down, both in personnel and equipment. After 2014 still, the Navy had to optimize the fleet for operations in maritime regions such as the Mediterranean. In UNIFIL alone, we maintained an uninterrupted presence for 20 years. And I think Brazil was 12 years. The mandate will only end in December of this year, and the Aegean Sea were engaged for more than a decade. These commitments had consequences for naval armament in particular. Search and rescue in the Mediterranean, counting vessels of Lebanon, and Coast Guard duties elsewhere, all of this did not require high-intensity warfare capabilities. And when resources are limited, you procure what you need to accomplish today's mission. Anything related to the future becomes a luxury. We must learn our lessons from this time for the way in which we maintain the operational readiness of our armed forces in the future. So, how has our view changed then? If we are being honest, we must acknowledge that as an organization, we clearly were not capable of doing both after 2014. Rebuilding our defense capability and at the same time sustaining our international commitments. As a reliable ally, we choose the latter and accepted that this would come at the expense of our military core capabilities, a trend that would continue for years. And let me say it again, in 2014, NATO started to view things differently and changed its strategy, as did the Bundeswehr. It simply happened too slowly and not decidedly enough. Ultimately, there was a lack of willingness to see Russia as a hostile actor, both within the armed forces and among the general public. But the famous line from Christian Morgenstern's poem, "That which must not, cannot be," is no basis for a strategy. On the 24th of February 2022, we learned that ignoring military reality can be fatal. For weeks and months, we had watched the Russian troop buildup along the border. And at the end of 21, being at the position of command of the fleet, I too had begun to ask myself what we would do if the worst would come to pass. What would be the areas of operation? Would we be able to supply ammunition as needed? How would we get our units out of there? And we took first measures. A few months later, I had been appointed chief of the German Navy. I felt transported back to my reality as a young officer of the watch. I was heading into the unknown, unsure whether this time it was the real thing. Perhaps it was the memory of this time that led to the decision I made a few hours after the Russian attack on Ukraine. All that floats put to sea. Take responsibility, show presence, be ready, this time not in the Mediterranean, but in our home waters. Rush was seen in the Navy. Ladies and gentlemen, the epochal shift of 24th of February 22, referred to in Germany as Zeitenwende, unleashed a transformative force unlike any other I had ever experienced in my career. In this context, Zeitenwende is not merely a political term. It must be understood as a mission for the armed forces, and the Navy is not at the periphery. It is, as always, at its center. But how do you mobilize a large organization that had settled into its comfort zone after years of supposed predictability and under conditions of chronic scarcity? Everyone in the Bundeswehr was asking that question. Military buildup. That was something we were not familiar with, and in parts we are not familiar with it today. We had accumulated great experience in achieving respectable military results, with ever fewer resources. But rebuilding a service technologically in personnel and in mindset was something none of us had ever done. Within the Navy, we agreed that only we ourselves could produce an answer. And so we set our new course, quite literally, with a new strategy, Course Marine, the Navy's navigation plan. We developed an ambitious idea for our naval forces. We wanted to demonstrate that following our immediate response to Russia's unlawful attack, we now had to rethink our strategy. The new reality, which continues to this day, has given rise to a clear focus of effort. We are putting defense at the center, and we are orienting ourselves towards Russia as a hostile actor. Its combat capability is the minimum aspiration we need to have for our own military effectiveness in NATO. And our adversary's capabilities are growing. In Ukraine, Russia learns something new every day. At the same time, Ukraine's defensive struggle has opened the eyes in many Western armed forces. Never before have we seen a war like this, let alone fought one. At the same time, Russia acts against German interests. We have seen it in the Baltic Sea, and we have seen it on our doorsteps. So it is imperative that we draw conclusions from what we observe in the Black Sea. We are learning about modern naval combat, and above all, the importance of uncrewed systems. Ukraine has succeeded in significantly damaging the Russian Black Sea fleet, thus degrading it and restricting its freedom of maneuver, all in the public eye. We are likewise learning from the wars in the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and the Red Sea. And we have to take into account that the adversary learns as well. In a recent Russian-Chinese exercise in the Pacific, more than 13,000 personnel and 60 vessels employed procedures derived from the war against Ukraine. New tactics and technologies are calling many long-held certainties into question. We must learn from everything we observe elsewhere and apply those lessons wherever we intend to assume responsibilities, and we do. As the German Navy, you do not have the luxury of preparing ourselves to perfection solely for our home waters in the Baltic Sea and the North Sea. We are, that's a fact, a blue and brown water navy, and we will remain one. We must defend our freedom across multiple theaters, from the waters around Greenland to the Persian Gulf, but with one priority, the northern flank. Ladies and gentlemen, how can a navy that spent decades responding to entirely different scenarios be made combat ready in a short space of time? I have a two-part answer to this. One part is about technology, and the other one is about people. Even from a technological perspective, changing course is not easy in an organization where time was never the constraint, but money always was. To this day, the Bundeswehr's procurement procedures are geared towards thoroughness, completeness, and legal certainty. But when the adversary is virtually at the entrance of your own harbor, there's no time to build a new fleet. I do not need the much-wanted gold-plated solution, not at all. I must deter and fight with what I have and procure what is available and works, and that fast. In the Navy, we examined what we could achieve by our own means. Innovation was not to remain merely a buzzword. And so, after 22, we launched operational experimentation campaigns, which have already led to initial procurements. For example, we are currently introducing an uncrewed underwater vehicle. It will operate alongside our world-class submarines and help us obtain a much better picture of the underwater threat in the Baltic very quickly. At the same time, we are equipping ships originally intended exclusively for international crisis management with cutting-edge air defense missiles, enabling us to deploy them in the world's most dangerous regions in the future. And we are doing so without a lengthy process, simply by installing the Ukraine-proven Iris-T missiles on our ship using organic assets only. All of this, from the first idea to successful live firings in roughly 12-month time, which is a record time in armaments. Yesterday's successful launch of a long-range attack missile in the Atlantic is another addition to this type of success story, which I'm very satisfied with, from the idea to the live firing in 6 months. The second part of my answer concerns people. I have experienced more than one Zeitenwende in the Navy. 1989, 2001, 2014, and 2022. Time and again, I have set sail with the Navy into the unknown. Perhaps my most important experience is this. Ultimately, the quality of the so-called processes is absolutely secondary. It is people who apply those procedures, operate the technology, and breathe life into our structures. To achieve something as great as a historic buildup of our naval forces, I have to win the hearts and minds of the men and women who serve on board and ashore day by day. And that is why it's so important to me to place the people of the Navy at the heart of our strategy and of my annual commander's intent. It is their attitude and their determination to achieve successes, both great and small, that will be decisive if our reconstruction as a whole is to succeed. It was always important to me not to point the finger at others, but to take responsibilities ourselves for the things we can change. And the same applies to the men and women of the Navy. For the positive record of these years is above all an achievement of our personnel. There are the ones who put the Zeitenwende into practice with heavy workloads and tasks with tight deadlines. I had to demand a great deal of them, and they delivered. Ladies and gentlemen, we are in the midst of setting priorities and reorienting our naval forces. We might wish to be able to concentrate on defending NATO's so-called northern flank, but reality might be different. We must respond when political leaders call upon the Navy to intervene. And with the recent rapid deployment of two warships towards the Strait of Hormuz, we demonstrated that we can meet this requirement, and we have to do this. This may rightly be regarded as a confirmation our Navy matters. Naval forces allow a quick and effective response to crises across the globe, and they send political signals that are seen. At the same time, our advice must make one thing clear. Today, we need every unit and every sailor and soldier geared to our core mission. How can these two imperatives be reconciled? My view is that in international crisis management, we must take a very close look at what we are employing naval forces for. Particularly at a time of scarce resources, the political and strategic objective must justify an operation that is far away from our core mission. Such an objective must be linked to a clear and measurable military task. The commitment must have clearly defined parameters. How long will we remain in a crisis region, and what criteria would trigger an earlier withdrawal? In the case of the deployment towards the Persian Gulf that I just mentioned, the objectives were convincing and the military tasks clear. With regard to our missions of Lebanon and the Aegean, the situation is different today than when we started the missions decades ago. We remain connected to these regions and their navies, and will continue to support them. But my advice is clear. We should no longer deploy warships there. The good news is that the Navy is growing for the first time in decades. A larger fleet will also restore greater flexibility in the years ahead. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not giving away any secret when I tell you that at the end of the month, I will leave behind my Navy that is heading for new shores. As an organization, we are not yet where we need to be, but we have a plan. We have clearly identified gaps in equipment, highlighted personnel as the decisive factor, and repeatedly stressed the need for faster procurement and greater availability. Yet we must not be content with announcements and good intentions. At the beginning of this year, I once again set out in my commander's intent what the situation demands of everyone of us in the Navy. Looking back over the past few years and my life in the armed forces, I see that never before in the Navy's history have the conditions been more favorable. I see a government that has made the build-up of the Bundeswehr an explicit objective of government policy. I see financial headroom that affords us opportunities which need fear no international comparison. And despite all the prophets of doom, I see a society that stands behind its armed forces and their mission, which is not comparable to the years when I joined the Navy. These favorable conditions impose a clear mission on the Navy. We must renew ourselves. We must once again place the essence of the military profession at the center of our endeavor, and we must take responsibility for the tasks that lie before each and every one of us. This focus on the core mission is what will prepare us for combat. But prevailing in battle requires not only equipment. Ships don't fight, people do. Even in highly technologized warfare, success will ultimately depend on the individual sailors and soldiers who, as a crew, form a fighting community and who fulfill their mission with complete trust in one another. I was able to perform my duties as Chief of the Navy only because I knew that I could rely on the people of the Navy and on the many international colleagues and friends whom I had made the privilege of gaining along the way. This international network has proved resilient and invaluable in many situations. And as Chief of the Navy, I too was able to stand by others when they needed me. It is something instilled in seafarers from the very beginning. You need to know people before you need people. Ladies and gentlemen, fellow sailors, throughout my life I've set sail with the Navy into the unknown time and time again. I did not always know what lay ahead, and there are some experiences I would gladly have done without. But I always knew that I could rely on the people at my side. And for that, I'm profoundly grateful. Thank you very much.